Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of Leading Through Adversity. We'll kick off the show here just momentarily after a word from our sponsor. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Leading Through Adversity, the podcast, LTA. As always, I'm your host, Jesus Campa. Looking forward to bringing you an exciting interview, one that I truly enjoyed this several weeks ago, taping it and recording it and bringing it to you. It's very informative. The individual that I am going to introduce you to here just momentarily was a world of enlightenment. I'm telling you, this individual understands leadership, understands the problems that leadership is going through, talks about the issues and how they overcame 2020 with the COVID crisis and things like that. So I hope you all enjoy the show as much as I enjoyed bringing it to you. And I hope everyone's having a good week or a good weekend, depending on when you're listening to the show. Let me just tell you a little bit about our guest. It was very exciting to have the opportunity to speak to Jeff Morrell. Jeff Morrell is the co-founder of Planet Subaru. He founded the dealership in 1998, and it was known as the Under dealership. And he built it into one of the most successful privately held car dealerships in the United States. He later started other businesses in the automotive retail industry, as well as in real estate, telecommunications, and in insurance. And his businesses generate over $100 million in annual revenue. So this man knows about businesses and entrepreneurship, I can tell you that. His achievements in building profitable and ethical companies have been featured in a variety of national media, including the USA Today, Entrepreneur Magazine, Automotive News, the Boston Globe, and many, many others. And I'm going to tell you one thing, man. This is an interview that you all need to pay close attention to. It was a lot of fun. So, ladies and gentlemen, without further ado, Jeff Morrell.
Hello, everybody. Jesus Eddie Campa with Leading Through Adversity, CEO and owner of Leading Through Adversity. Today, I have the pleasure of speaking to a very successful leader, a very successful individual who's going to talk to us a little bit about how to grow our businesses and continue to grow in a right way. Joining me today is Jeff Morrell. How you doing, Jeff?
Very good. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, it's our pleasure, Jeff. Jeff, why don't you start off by telling us a little bit about yourself?
Okay, let's just start. I'm talking to you from Charlottesville, Virginia today, and I moved here 2 years ago from Boston, where I had moved with my wife in 1998, and my brother also moved north from our native Virginia to open up our first business, which is Planet Subaru. It was a bankrupt Subaru dealership in Norwell, just outside of Boston. We later moved it to Hanover. And then we would open up related businesses and some completely unrelated as the years went on. One of the things you see is that when you have a business that's early, you don't have a lot of cash flow or momentum or bandwidth to do many other things. But once it gets rolling, it's a lot easier to borrow money, and the opportunities to hear about businesses that are for sale, those come a little more easily to you. So it's a lot easier to open businesses and build businesses once you already have one that's working well. So anyway, the reason why I'm in Charlottesville is that 20 years of doing that was enough to wear me out. And I had felt it happening in the last few years that I was there, and we had done a good job in grooming a team of people that could run the businesses without me being there. And so I check in remotely and visit, from time to time, but I'm entering a new phase of my life as an author, most recently of the book Profit Wise, How to Make More Money in Business by Doing the Right Thing. And hopefully we can talk about some of the ideas that I discuss in that book today.
Oh, absolutely. Actually, when I started my law enforcement career 27 years ago, I retired December 20th of last year. But when I started out my career, the sheriff at the time who pinned my badge on me, Leo Samaniego, said to me, "Eddie, I'm pinning this badge on you, but I'm going to task you with one thing. Please don't ever tarnish this badge, and always do the right thing because it's the right thing to do." You know, and at that time, I was kind of like, I know he always said that, but I was kind of wondering, like, did he just say that to me, or did he say that to every person that he pinned the badge on, right? And so I started noticing, like making sure, and I noticed that, no, he wasn't saying things to people, you know? And I always took that to heart. It really meant a lot to me. And I always try to do the right thing because it's the right thing to do. I do feel that I'm a public servant by heart. So I definitely want to talk to you about some of the things that you wrote in that book and guide us with why it's important to do the right thing because it's the right thing to do. But so tell us a little bit about how your 2020 was. It's been very interesting for a lot of people. How was your 2020?
You know, it's like that Chinese character that you hear about proverbially for crisis involves the two words in Chinese. I think they come danger and opportunity. And I think about that whenever bad circumstances arrive at our door, you know, it's going to be tough, but there's also a lot of opportunity there. And I guess it was terrifying for us in February, March, because the bulk of our revenue comes from retail businesses. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the Northeast was hit really hard and was basically shut down for a couple months. And during that time, we didn't know it was going to happen. Our payroll is literally millions of dollars a year. So we were prepared to weather a storm, but it couldn't last that long. Unfortunately, it didn't. As it turns out, COVID really redefined who the winners and the losers were in our economy for that year. And of course, there are businesses like in entertainment and restaurants really got hurt badly. But as the year went on with the stimulus checks and people bored at home, they ended up actually buying more cars than we would have expected. And it turned out to be a pretty good year. And so far, 2021 is continuing that trend.
Awesome. Well, that's good for you. That's good to hear. I mean, and you're absolutely right. It defined who the winners and the losers were, because honestly, for myself, you know, we have two businesses that we run. We run America's Best Strategic Security Group, which has been a business that I've had for probably about 15 years, but it wasn't until about 2017 when I actually went ahead and created it into an actual business. And, you know, it's a security consulting firm. And as well, we do security guard services, public, private investigations, backgrounds and stuff like that. And then we opened up Leading Through Adversity in 2018. And, you know, we thought that we were going to get blown out of the water. And because of some of the situations that came along with COVID, the security industry just really blew up here in El Paso. And we saw some really good things, and we were able to put a lot of people to work in a time where a lot of people were looking for work. So that was something we were very happy with. And Leading Through Adversity, you know, gave us the opportunity to knock into a different channel. We're a leadership development group, and it gave us the opportunity to basically still go ahead and reach people through these avenues. So yeah, absolutely. 2020 was a time of either, it was kind of a sink or swim type of situation, you know? And so that was interesting. Thank you. Leadership. You obviously know about leadership. I mean, when you got a payroll that's worth millions and millions, what is your definition of leadership?
You know, I guess if you look in the textbook, you get something about how it's all about organizing people in pursuit of a common purpose. I mean, that's the way I've experienced it anyway. It's pretty simple definition. But I think it's much more than that. For me, I think it's the challenge of solving problems with a group of people. and I've always found that my preference is to lead from behind. And what I mean by that, Greenleaf, Robert Greenleaf, an author, called that servant leadership, where I don't really see it as my job to run first up the hill holding the banner into the wave of machine gun fire, to use the military metaphor, although there are probably a select few times where that's required. But I like the idea of building consensus around ideas in the companies. And what I found is that when a person feels like the project is something that he or she is controlling and he or she came up with it, they're much more likely to accomplish it than me telling them, here's what you need to do. So I find myself, as time goes on in meetings now, I speak almost not at all. And what I like to do is, if there's an idea that I think was missed that the group of people assembled didn't cover, then I'll wait till the end and make sure that whatever I'm saying has a question mark at the end. You know, did you guys think about this idea, or did you consider the consequences of this particular course of action? And I find that people take that sense of ownership seriously, and that helps make sure the project goes well.
Right, actually, I totally agree with you on the servant leadership thing. Now, just out of curiosity, I mean, I've noticed that throughout the last several years, I've noticed that while there is a defined definition of what leadership is, and you gave a perfect example of leadership trait, you know, one of the leadership styles being a servant leader, and being in public service myself for so many years, you know, a public servant is very important. But I've come to realize that, you know, leadership really needs to be kind of unmasked, because there kind of seems to be a loss of what leadership really is. Regardless of what side you sit on the political spectrum, you're seeing nowadays that leadership is kind of in crisis, because I think half of the spectrum feels that leadership is this, the other half of the spectrum feels that leadership is that. And just using myself as an example, you know, I've led several organizations where some organizations thought I was a great leader and some other organizations thought I was a horrible leader. And I think that really the definition of leadership is really left to the person that's being led's perspective as to what they define as what true leadership is. Because I've seen people who feel that leadership is basically that person, the good leadership is a person who lets them get away with whatever they want.
Yeah, I think you have to adapt to each person. Certainly, when I think about the interaction we've had with the people on our teams over the years, there are some people that respond to stimuli that I have a very difficult time giving. And what I mean by that is that I'm generally very calm. You can tell just by my demeanor. I don't yell and scream. I don't throw things for dramatic effect. It's just, I don't know how to do that. It's not my style. But for whatever reason, because of the nature of the families that they grew up in, or maybe some early mentorship they had professionally, that's the only thing that gets their attention. And so I really struggle with that particular kind of team member. Fortunately, I want to draw a contrast, and I know you've done it on prior podcasts, the difference between serving in a political environment or a public service environment versus a corporate private sector environment. And so we have the ability to select the people on the team and greater flexibility when the fit's just not there to try to help that person come around to our vision. If they don't come around to our vision, then ultimately we can ask them to find employment somewhere else. And that's, you know, considering the background that you have, you know, you can't tell the mayor to go find a job in another city, you know, if the mayor doesn't get it. And mayors, just like automotive salespeople or accountants, or sometimes they just don't get it.
Yeah, that's for sure. And, you know, that's one of the things that I've been enjoying about the private sector. You know, with our security company, we were obviously, I've been able to. Okay, just lost my microphone on that one. Sorry about that. You know, I've been able to pick my team and pick the people that I think that are going to do a good job and stuff like that for us, and assign the investigators for where they need to be, you know, where they need to go. And you're right, it's just so much simpler in the corporate world, in the private sector, to be able to do that than it is in the public sector. And I wish that the public sector would lend itself a little bit more to how the private sector works, and it would make a lot of leaders' jobs in that industry a lot easier for sure.
Yeah, and I think we're at a time too, you know, in our political environment, we don't need to spend a lot of time or linger on that, but the divisiveness, or the sense that people have that people don't see the world the same way, is very pronounced right now. So I think it's hard to bridge that gap. I find in our company, we actually maybe we can talk about hiring right now, that we put in as early as our recruiting ads the values of the company, and we ask potential applicants to visit our website and become familiar with the unusual values we have as a dealership. We in the case of our retail automotive businesses, we market them as your undealerships, the alternative to the typical dealership experience. And we do a lot of really neat things that differentiate ourselves from the typical dealership. And one of those is that we're pretty environmentally responsible in terms of our dealership operations. And we've done really well recruiting people that have traditionally been excluded from opportunities in the retail automotive sector. And so we want to make sure that people joining us know about that commitment. And if they think that's silly or they don't believe in it or they don't agree with it, well, that's okay. We just don't want them taking up our hiring resources and certainly don't want them joining our team. So the clearer we are about our own values and the more successful we are communicating them, the better off we are building a team of people who get it and see the world our way.
Yeah, you know, you bring up a great topic, and it's, let's get into that. Let's talk about what you discuss in your book. You know, the important thing is, you just nailed it right there with what you said. You know, in the public sector, you know, we do have values, mission statements, and all of this stuff, and that's one of the things that when we hire people, you know, we try to go off of is that these are the visions, these are the mission statements, the vision statements of the organization. However, one of the things in the public sector that I found is that a lot of the people that are employed in those organizations don't even know what the vision statement was or is, or don't remember. They remembered when they got hired because they had to, but then there's no accountability. And I've noticed that in the private sector, it's a lot easier to hold people accountable. But let's start off with going back to the book and talking about the main purpose of making more, is it making more money by doing the right thing?
Yes. I think the major premise of the book is, I think the conventional wisdom says you have to be, you know, a really hard ass kind of owner to make things happen in the business world. You know, you've got to kick ass and take names, and you need to be concerned with your own needs instead of other people's. And I think that's a false choice. And what we've proved in our businesses, and I discuss in the book, is that when you're winning and you can find a way to make sure that other people want you to keep winning because they're benefiting, then they're going to help you keep winning. And I'll give you an example. And I like to use concrete examples. We in 2011 put a huge solar array on the roof of one of our dealerships, and it cost a fortune. And a lot of my fellow business owners, you know, heard about it and told me that I was crazy to spend that much money on something that wouldn't directly supply revenue. And it was something that was very important to me as a fundamental value for me personally, and also a corporate value that we minimize our environmental impact. So I thought that it was a good idea on its own merits, but I also knew something that I was pretty convinced that customers would respond to that. And that if we did a good job about communicating that we had done this with prospective customers, that people would be willing to drive past other dealerships to come do business with us. And it turns out that was the case. So what looked like, you know, a boondoggle financially for the company has turned out great, because we have access to customers who wouldn't have heard about us at all, or having heard about us, now we have a really positive differentiator for them. So there are ways that you can, if you do it thoughtfully and intelligently, you can earn more money and also accomplish positive values and improve your corner of the world at the same time.
That's an awesome way of looking at things. Yeah, absolutely. You know, and that is true. You know, society deems, you know, especially like in the law enforcement world, it's some tying it into what you just said, you know, a lot of people think that we have to kick ass, take names, be brutal, be heavy-handed. And in reality, we really don't. You know, I've spent my entire career, 27 years, dealing with community service, community-based policing, you know, and that's basically dealing with procedural justice, treating others the way you want to be treated. It's the golden rule. And, you know, I've had a lot of people ask me, it's like, why don't people ever run from you? Or why don't people ever want to fight you? And I'm like, because you don't have to agitate the situation. You know, you can neutralize it and de-escalate it by talking and letting that person be heard, and giving that person the ability to tell their side of the story. And while you become empathetic and you understand it, then you relay the message that because of his actions or their actions or her actions, this is the consequence. And it's basically kind of, I mean, it's two different spectrums, but it aligns with exactly with what you said.
Yeah, I see, as you're describing it, exactly the principle in the book that what you're doing is you're allowing members of the community to win.
Right.
And they have a safer community. They have fewer crimes. I think that's one of the things, and I'm not a law enforcement expert at all, but I'm an active citizen and a reader of many things. And I think that it's really important that we remember that people, even in communities that are really, really suffering from a lot of crime, most of the people are not participating in that crime and really want to be protected from it. And so they have some partnership and common interest in the police being successful. And if you can find a way to earn their trust, then you're going to have a much more successful partnership and relationship with them over the years than, as you said, you know, taking a very hard-edged, you know, forceful approach. And the metaphor is the same, I think, in the private sector.
Awesome. Now, of course, you know, everybody, when you think of a car dealership, when you think of car salesmen, everybody thinks about that heavy-handed, heavy pressure sales tactic. How do you address that in your, is that addressed in the book? As sometimes if that's not necessarily the way to approach it. And basically, I think you already answered that question, but you know, how do you get that approach?
Yeah, I mean, I think when we open the dealership and we're trying to, you know, really pinpoint the focus of how we are going to operate, we saw a really powerful differentiator in the marketplace that people are really disgusted with the way they get treated overall in dealerships. And there's a reason why those behaviors continue, and we can talk about that or not, but there's a reason they're hard to stamp out. But so that stuff's what's going on in the market. And we saw, well, if we provide something that provides less friction for people, you know, just an easier experience, you know, professional, competent people who listen well, who are conscientious and return phone calls. And when someone comes in and wants a vehicle, you give them straight answers, that you can make a really good business model around that. You might not make as much on that single transaction, but we've always taken the long approach. I'm very happy to make a slow buck. I don't need the quick buck. Is that if you can satisfy the person, they come back and they keep coming back and they send their friends. And not only that, but they want to do service with you too, because the automotive repair business has a very similar negative impression in many people's minds too. So if you can offer them a better service experience, then you just have this great flywheel effect in terms of people never wanting to go anywhere else.
And it seems like both of our industries are pretty much aligned, because, you know, while people love the police, they also love to hate us, you know, because we do have that reputation of, you know, I realized early in my career that I should have become a fireman, because everybody loves firemen regardless of what they do. You know, as a police officer, we're often seen as that person you call when it's hit the isolating fan, because the only outcome is that someone's either going to get beat up, shot, or taken to jail. And it's not necessarily always that case. You know, we can offer different approaches and different avenues, and trying to change that through procedural justice and community-based policing is something that we've tried. And it's worked in some areas, but the culture, and I think that's what you were alluding to, is the culture to change it and to stamp it out is really hard. I mean, it's going to take a long time to change that culture.
Yeah. And I think one of the ways we've done it, going back to hiring again too, is that I think one of the mistakes that many companies make is that they probably put too much emphasis on prior experience doing the exact job. And the risk of doing that, well, there are multiple risks, but one, you tend to import bad habits. So, I mean, again, I don't know anything about law enforcement, but if you think about, if you hire your own police officer and you have a good process that weeds out people who aren't doing it for the right reasons, and you can school them in your vision of policing, you're going to have a much more successful time getting that person to execute your version of justice or policing than someone who's been working elsewhere for 5, 10, 15 years. Maybe you can get them to see things your way, but they've got a lot of ingrained habits. So in the case of our retail businesses, let's use the car dealership as an example. We don't hire experienced salespeople. We don't want people who have sold cars before because we don't want that toxicity coming into our environment. We'd rather start with someone, you know, a conscientious, smart, personable person, motivated, and take that person, you know, school that person our particular approach. And then we know they're doing it our way, and we don't have to worry about them, you know, importing any bad habits.
Right. Jeff, you know, I mean, it sounds like your book is actually a really good tool that would fit into a law enforcement mindset administrative as well. Because it seems like we're both running on the same issues. I can see how your book would relate to us. What's the title of the book again?
Profit-Wise, How to Make More Money in Business by Doing the Right Thing.
Yeah, I really like that. I really think it runs parallel to how law enforcement should run, you know, maybe with a different title, but I can see how it runs exactly with it because we seem to have the same issues. Now, when it comes to hiring, you're absolutely right. You know, we always want that experienced officer. We want to be able to take them and mold. You save the time by not having to train them and mold them because they got the experience. But like you said, they come with bad habits. And when they don't align with your vision or the direction you want to take that agency with, you run into hard times. That's why, you know, when we have our own police academies, depending on the size of the agency, we like to get that new individual, train them, mold them into the particular way we want them. Then we run into a major problem. We train them right at the academy, and then we send them out to the real world. Then you have that experienced officer who comes in and tells them, forget everything you learned at the academy. That's the wrong way of doing it. I want to show you the way it's really done. While there is a preference to that, I mean, there is some reality to that. Things are done a little bit different, but you basically have now, tainted that young recruit, because now everything that he's learned, he's going to be taught the wrong way to doing that. Do you guys experience that in the automotive industry?
I think the industry probably does. And historically we did when we first opened, because we hadn't worked out all of these philosophies that are so central to our operating core now. But I think that the thing that businesses struggle with the most is shifting a culture because they're impatient. And we realized that this was going to take for us, you know, building this undealership vision wasn't going to happen right away. And again, to use the law enforcement model, there's, you know, you can't just fire that experienced officer, and you might need that experienced officer because he or she is bringing a lot of other good skills. But over time, if you have the most problematic ones, you can reassign, you know, you can put them in roles where they're not mentoring the young people. Not that you have to take them off the force, right, but that you're just not, you know, you're not using those people as your trainers. And in our case, over many years, you eventually filter those people out. And you got to remember, we opened in 98. So we've been, in the case of the Subaru dealership, the oldest business we have, it's 21 years. So we've had a lot of opportunity to ease people out of the business who don't get it.
You know, and again, that's the difference between private and public. I mean, so what kind of advice would you give to, let's just say, you know, let's stick with the law enforcement theme, a chief of police, or I mean, even like a city manager whose tenure is only as long as the mayor or the council that hired them. I mean, that could be anywhere from 2 to 4 years. And the majority of police chiefs nowadays, you know, their tenure is 1 to 2 years. Wow. And councilmen, yeah, and mayors and stuff, they want to see change and we want to see it now. But then if you move too fast, then they hold you accountable, because then basically when you move too fast, you pretty much implode everything. So what kind of advice would you give to somebody who's listening to your message that says that it takes time? And we get it. I mean, trust me, I understand that to change a culture, it takes time. Unfortunately, in the positions that I'm in, I'm not going to be given 20 years to make that culture change. So any advice for having to make a quick culture change?
You know, the metaphor, I guess I used before, is like the difference between a quick buck and a slow buck. And the only kind of bucks I know how to make are slow ones. I know how to make a lot of them, but they're slow. And I can't imagine being in that position where you have to turn a culture and organization around in a year. I mean, you have to come in and break so many things. And as you said, that's risky for so many reasons, for alienating different constituencies, and you get opposition from your own ranks, you know, when you come in and you want to make that many changes that quickly. You know, I think it takes time. Probably the most effective way you shift a culture is by bringing in new people. And you can't turn over a police force or any other public sector, you know, workforce that quickly. So let me just tap out and say I can't help you with that.
No, and you know what, Jeff? You actually just did help me with that. You just proved a point. And here's the difference. You're successful. You know how to make a slow buck, as you said, but you know how to make a lot of them. Well, could you imagine if you took a good police chief and allowed him to do the things that he needed to do, slowly, methodically, planned out, allowed him to weed out the bad individuals that didn't need to be there. Because like you said, they would eventually weed themselves out. You move and you transfer the bad officers. And then if you allowed that police chief to bring his people with him, the people that have helped him become successful maybe in other organizations, and you allowed him to take those 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, even 10 years to make a complete change of a department, could you imagine the success that we would have across the nation with police chiefs and police agencies, because we're spending the time nurturing, maturing, and creating the division and the department that we really want to see. So you actually proved the point.
And it might be that the only way then to accomplish that is, I mean, maybe give this one piece of advice, that that police chief find that community that's willing to do that, you know, that is that patient and is willing to put the trust in that individual to make those changes over the long term. Yeah. And that's certainly, you know, you have to, you bloom where you're planted, and the best soil is going to produce the best flowers. And I think the only option you have is to find a situation that's suited to that kind of long-term approach.
Yeah. I spent 27 years trying to find that place. So I went to the private sector instead.
Yeah,
right. It doesn't exist.
Well, I'm sorry to hear that, because, you know, we need, you know, I think public service and even politicians, you know, we love to make fun of politicians, but I even the ones I disagree with, I have a ton of respect for them, because of the sacrifices they make. They could make a lot more money doing private sector jobs with a lot less BS, and they do it because they believe in the ideas that are important to them. And like I said, I don't always agree with those ideas. And there are some politicians that I really think are pretty dangerous. But I respect that they're willing to give up a lot to serve the community that way.
Right. Well, you know, one of the hardest things that I have found, especially in my life, is the amount of criticism that we take. And this goes across to just about anybody. I mean, even in the private sector. You know, we take a lot of criticism for doing the right things, and yet those that do the wrong things are sometimes elevated to godlike statuses. And, you know, you try to do the right thing, but you get tired of getting beat up, you know, and being criticized and being told over and over that you don't know what you're doing, and that you're doing it the wrong way, and yada, yada, that at the point it just comes in where you just wave the white flag and say, you know what, forget it, I'm out. And I think that's why we're seeing a lack of We're seeing a lack of good leadership across all political aspects, you know, because the good guys that really thought they could change the world have gotten beat up so much that they know they can't do it, and they decide not to run anymore.
Yeah, it's a good point. You know, in terms of the cost, the personal costs, I mean, you basically can't run for office now without literally getting death threats. I mean, you run for town council and you have people threatening to kill you, and you have to ask the question, why would any reasonable person want to subject themselves to that? Unfortunately, we still have some people that are willing to weather all of that difficult stuff because they believe in what they're doing, and we do need more of them.
Yep, absolutely. Awesome, Jeff. Well, I want to thank you for your time. I want to give you the opportunity to one more either plug the book, plug any of your companies or anything you want. It's a little free advertising, your website, whatever it is. And when your book comes out, how do we get a hold of it?
Yeah, so the book is out February 28th. So just a few days from now while we're taping, and probably by the time this episode airs, it'll be out. And listeners can learn more about it at jeffmorrill.com, M-O-R-R-I-L-L. And I have a lot of resources on the website. I'm donating all the royalties for the book. I didn't do this to sell books. I've enjoyed such abundance in my life that I wanted to use this opportunity to pass along these lessons, because I thought that if businesses incorporated more of these practices, and not just businesses, but other institutions, that they might improve their little corner of the world. So we have lots of resources at the website for like in terms of improved hiring practices, the interview scripts that we use during interviews, lots of the same stuff we use in our businesses every day. So I invite people to visit the website.
Awesome. Well, Jeff, I know you're a busy man, and I appreciate you taking time to talk to our audience and give us a little bit of an education. I know I learned quite a bit from you today, and I'm really looking forward to it. I'm definitely going to buy that book because I really do think it relates to my field as well. And I know that I might just pick up a couple of extra copies to send them to a couple of people that I know need to hear that message. So thanks
Great.
Again, Jeff.
Thanks, Eddie.
Absolutely. Well, there you have it. Leading Through Adversity. We'll be back.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, there you have it. Our interview with Jeff Morrill. Please go out there and buy the book. I know as soon as I'm done here editing and stuff, I'm going to go ahead and order me a copy of that book. And I just might pick up a copy or two to send to a couple of people that I know could definitely listen to Jeff's message. So once again, ladies and gentlemen, this is Jesus Campa with my words of wisdom. Please don't ever let the same snake bite you twice. We'll catch you next week. Bye.